and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about Paralandra by C.S. Lewis. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. This is the second of three consecutive shows with different guests on The Space Trilogy by C.S. Lewis. Last week, we discussed the first book in the series, Out of the Silent Planet, with David Whalen, and next week, we'll cover the third book, That Hideous Strength. Today, our guest is Monica Hilder, a professor of English at Trinity Western University, which is near Vancouver in British Columbia, Canada. She's the author of three books on C.S. Lewis, including The Gender Dance, Ironic Subversion in C.S. Lewis's Cosmic Trilogy. She joins us by phone as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Monica, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Well, thank you so much, John. This is just a pleasure and honor to participate.
Why is Paralandra by C.S. Lewis a great book?
It is an absolutely stunning, gorgeous book. It was Lewis's favorite book, and there's just so much about it. The whole idea of visiting a planet that is unfallen. What does temptation look like? A really big question is what really was Lewis doing about gender? And of course, there's always that question: was he sexist? Was he not? I think really the most memorable part of the book, well, if I can even say that, but is this great cosmic dance at the end. It's absolutely stunning. And yeah, the book, it is inspired an opera by Donald Swan, which that opera was actually approved by Lewis. So yes, it's an amazing book.
We're going to talk about all of that. We won't be singing for anybody, which is probably good news, but we'll definitely talk about the story, the characters, the planet Venus, gender temptation, the cosmic dance, all of it. Monica, the book begins, Paralandra begins, with a first-person narrator on a journey to meet Elwyn Ransom, the protagonist of Out of the Silent Planet, the book we discussed last week. A few sentences into the opening paragraph, the narrator says, quote, "Who could imagine that a little farther on in that quiet landscape I should meet and shake by the hand a man who had lived and eaten and drunk in a world 40 million miles distant from London, who had seen this earth from where it looks like a mere point of green fire, and who had spoken face to face with a creature whose life began before our planet was inhabitable," unquote. What's going on here?
Okay, well, this is a fascinating opening because Lewis has actually placed himself as the character Lewis in the story. He's the narrator. He's the friend of Elwyn Ransom, and he's going on to meet Elwyn Ransom in his cottage, and he's getting really freaked out because he realizes, yes, I mean, Elwyn Ransom has met the Eldila, the angels. He's been in outer space. He's been to Malacandra, to Mars. He promised to meet Elwyn in order to help him on this journey, which is going to take Elwyn to Paralandra, to Venus.
We met Elwyn Ransom in last week's episode on Out of the Silent Planet. He's the hero of that book. He's a philologist. He's based a little bit on J.R.R. Tolkien.
Well, he is in that sense because Tolkien was the philologist and, of course, Lewis honoring his friend and so on. So in that sense, I would say yes.
As Lewis meets him, we learn that Elwyn Ransom is going on a voyage to Venus. And by the way, that's an alternative title for Paralandra. It's sometimes been marketed as Voyage to Venus, which sounds like a nice science fiction movie or something.
That was the American edition. So a lot of us came to it with that title.
So he does, though, go on a voyage to Venus. How does he get there?
Well, the fascinating thing is that Ransom needs to enter this coffin-like box naked because it's going to be really warm on Paralandra, and Lewis's task is to seal the coffin, and then he's transported to Paralandra by the Eldila.
Now, the coffin-sized box he goes into, that is a curious way to describe it. I'm thinking
who would want to climb into a coffin, right?
Yeah, exactly. Why would you get into a casket? Why is that the metaphor we're using here, a coffin-sized box?
That's a really important question, and I think it's the totally appropriate metaphor because the whole thing is that, you know, for Ransom to become this agent, especially for God, he has to die to himself, right? In the sense that he has to die to his egotism. He has to submit his whole self to God in order to accomplish the task that is set before him, which is to be a kind of savior of Perelandra. So it's totally appropriate. He goes with nothing, as it were.
So the coffin-sized box has a special kind of meaning. So does the name Ransom. Elwyn Ransom. What does that name mean? What is Lewis communicating to us?
Yes. So Elwyn, actually to an Anglo-Saxon word, anyway, means friend of the Eldila, elf friend, the Eldila, friend of the angels. So that's Elwyn. And Ransom, of course, the idea of saved as our ransom. So it's Elwyn Ransom's destiny to be a little Christ, and in this case on Perelandra, be the one who is in between, who stands between the innocence and the evil that is coming in the task to the fall on this innocent planet.
Now, remind us, who are the Eldila? Again, we met them in Out of the Silent Planet, but who are the Eldila? Why are they these special angelic figures?
Yes. So each planet has a ruling Eldila. So that's, you know, like the angel in charge of that planet. It's kind of like the idea that every nation has an angel, like Michael for Israel and so on. So they are, they're sometimes confused with people of students first reading these books, thinking that the Yorsa is in fact God, the divine. That's not true. So the angels who are serving the divine.
And they have these sort of magical powers or mystical powers where they can transport Elwyn Ransom from Earth to Perelandra, Venus.
Absolutely. These are, you know, the supernatural beings. They have angelic skills.
Now, what is Venus like in this book? Today, we know that Venus is pretty inhospitable, 900 degrees hot on its surface. That's hot enough to melt lead. The Venus, the Perelandra that Elwyn Ransom encounters is different.
Yeah, Lewis loves to think about how the planets, going back to Greco-Rome, are really associated with character types. And so the Roman goddess Venus, which, you know, who represents love and beauty and fertility and victory and all these wonderful things. So we can think, if we think of Venus as Lewis is characterizing the planet as kind of like the love principle, the goddess of love. And he even uses the language, he refers to the planet as the planet of love. And it's described in the book as being very warm, maternal, gorgeous. So we might think of it as sort of like the, quote, feminine principle, which boils down to the love principle.
And this stands in contrast to Mars, the planet we met in Out of the Silent Planet. Mars is masculine, it's male. Now we're on the female planet.
Yeah, Lewis, he's so taken by the idea of gender as being cosmic, like gender is a cosmic reality, and it cannot be reduced to a biological sex. So what is masculine is not the same as what we would call male, like maleness is an approximation of what is masculine, and female is an approximation of what is feminine. So Venus is feminine, but not female.
You raised a question as we first started talking, is C.S. Lewis sexist? He's sometimes accused of that because of the way he depicts Venus and its feminine nature. Do you think he's sexist? Is he anti-feminist? Is he feminist? Help us sort that out.
I do not think that he is sexist. I think it's the opposite. I think he's trying to show that we are, in fact, sexist. Yeah, this is one of the, really the hottest topic in our time as we're reading Lewis and other writers. One of the criticisms that comes up with the portrayal of the queen of Perelandra, you know, Perelandra's Eve, Tinadrel, is that some critics think that she's, you know, really stupid because she asks questions of Ransom, like, what is peace? You know, what is home? And then at the end of the book, she's asking her husband, King Tor, oh, what are arches? And so I think people misread this because we maybe have this idea that she should know. But the thing is, if you're on a perfect planet, how would you know what death is? You wouldn't know what that is. And she actually, I think she's actually brilliant and can run circles around most people who've had, you know, the education to answer these questions. One of the things that I find absolutely stunning about this book is how, you know, towards the end of the book, when Tor is, she has asked her husband Tor, you know, what are arches and all that, and he starts laughing and explains, you know, a little bit about what they are. And then he makes this statement that he has received this rational knowledge from her. He didn't come up with this on his own. And it's like, wait a minute, what is Lewis doing? Well, she has intuitively imparted this knowledge to him, which, of course, she got from God. And Lewis is doing this really cool thing because Tor is saying that really there's been a kind of a role reversal here. She begets, receives the knowledge, and he bears the knowledge, which is very sort of gender psychosexual imagery. So what he is doing is reversing this idea that, in this case, we can say males are more rational or more intellectual, and females, you know, are lesser. And we've got this reversal going on. And it's something that, you know, it goes back to earlier literature, Milton and so on, where actually intuitive reason is considered the higher form of reason. You get that in Paradise Lost and so on. So Lewis is having a lot of fun with this, and I think he expects us to get it, but in our time, it's harder maybe to process this thing. So it's easy maybe to think of Tinadrel as being stupid at first when you realize, oh my goodness, she's so brilliant at answering Ransom and Weston and so on.
You mentioned she's an Eve-like figure, and her husband Tor is an Adam-like figure. So we get to Venus, and we're in this Edenic kind of paradise. It's almost an ocean planet, but there are these floating islands. There's also fixed land. There's water everywhere. When we're in the Garden of Eden, of course, we're always wondering about temptation, the role of temptation coming into the story. Does temptation exist on Venus in this Edenic paradise that Lewis has built for us?
Yes, temptation is introduced by the character Weston, who becomes the unman. So just to go back a step, the guidance, the rule that Tinadrel and Tor have has to do with the fixed land. So everything's kind of floating, undulating islands, and there is a fixed land, and they're absolutely allowed to go to the fixed land, but they're not allowed to spend the night there. So it really is a metaphor for a trust, for movement, that you're just, you know, on the floating lands, and you can go to the fixed land, but this idea of being on the fixed land permanently, well, that they're not allowed to do. And the way that temptation works, Weston wants to get Eve, Tinadrel, to stay on the fixed land.
Monica, you've mentioned Weston, this character who shows up on Venus after Elwyn has arrived and we've met Queen Tinadrel and so forth. Weston shows up. Again, we know him from Out of the Silent Planet. He was one of the villains in that first novel in this trilogy. He shows up and he says he's a changed man.
Oh, well, he certainly has gotten to the next level of descent. So, you know, in Out of the Silent Planet, we can still see a kind of nobility about him. He is a villain. But there is this kind of remaining sort of noble quest for humanity aspect to him. And of course, in Out of the Silent Planet, he's, you know, as an amoral scientist, he's talking about this life force idea. So he doesn't believe in God, of course. He talks about the life force. And in Paralandra, he really takes it to the next level. And, you know, I would say he's really morphed into someone who, well, essentially we could say what we see in Weston now is a soul in the process of damnation, because he has literally called this so-called life force into himself. And that, of course, means demonic possession.
In Out of the Silent Planet, he is in the grip of a bad idea, sort of a scientism kind of idea, which he thinks is in the interests of humanity written large. But now he's on to some other problems, isn't he, with this idea of demonic possession almost.
It seems as if he's totally forgotten about scientism, you know, the whole, you know, interplanetary imperialism. But I think what Lewis is showing is that if you're on the track of scientism, you are essentially calling this demonic force into yourself, and Lewis is showing this is the outcome. So he's really showing what's behind scientism. And so what we see in Weston, I mean, he devolves into this absolutely grotesque being who absolutely delights in destruction.
So what's the conflict then? He arrives on the planet, here's Ransom, he's going to oppose and fight against Weston. How do they face off?
Well, they face off with so many really philosophical, theological arguments. So there's just a lot of conversation whereby Lewis allows us to really investigate, you know, what's behind all these ideas, scientism versus, you know, faith in God. The whole quest for Weston is to get the queen, Tynadrel, to become egotistical, to have, you know, classical self-reliant pride. And Ransom's task is to stand in between, to come alongside her, to support her. And he realizes eventually that if Weston, who is now the unman because he's possessed, if he had unlimited time to work on Tynadrel, she would eventually fail. She would eventually fall. So when you're dealing with evil, it has to be put down, and Ransom realizes he has got to actually kill the unman's body. He has got to kill the former, well, Weston, but now the unman who's inhabited by Satan.
And does he ultimately prevent a kind of new fall of man or a Venus version of the fall of man?
Absolutely. Weston fails. Ransom succeeds in preventing the fall of Paralandra. Paralandra remains perfect. It remains innocent.
So how does this book wrap up then? We've gone over the basics of the story. At the end of the book, though, there's this cosmic dance and a coronation. What happens there?
Okay, so that coronation is all about the Eorza, the ruling Eldila, Paralandra, himself, herself, one might say. But anyway, to hand over the authority of Paralandra to the king and queen. So, and as part of this whole coronation celebration, which takes a year in Paralandra's time, we have this unbelievable, you know, for us, absolutely stunning cosmic dance, also referred to as, you know, the great game. And it's this incredible interactive, you know, speaking, singing movement of really the entire cosmos. And this harks back to what medieval thinkers were doing with the geocentric universe, where everything beyond the moon is still in a cosmic harmony. So they're still singing the original song of creation. And so this is celebrated at the end of the book, where all of the characters and really every aspect of creation is in song, is in dance.
Your book is called The Gender Dance, Ironic Subversion in C.S. Lewis's Cosmic Trilogy. This is taken, I think, from the Cosmic Dance, the title you draw from the idea of the Cosmic Dance. What do you mean by the gender dance? What do you mean by ironic subversion?
It is the cosmic, the dance part that really gave me what I think is the appropriate metaphor with what Lewis is doing with gender. So we've got to remember he's thinking about gender as being cosmic realities, and of course he's also thinking of biological sex, which is, you know, a lesser form of gender. And so when we're thinking of gender in our time, we're definitely wrestling with questions of power, like who has the most power, right? Which comes from a Marxist paradigm, who is using authority or power, you know, to enslave, to make others lesser. So we have this kind of mindset of asking, you know, who has the most power. And what Lewis is showing, this is totally not biblical. The relations between the sexes, but all of humanity, and really ought to be one of harmony and based on the model of love, which is also a medieval concept, that the idea of hierarchy is not this top-down, rigid, satanic stuff going on, but it is interactive, it is fluid. So to have authority also means to abdicate egotism. And so we have everything in this gorgeous, fluid dance.
What do you mean by ironic subversion?
So Lewis is, I think, subverting our views of gender. So he holds to the idea of male headship in marriage, so that whole biblical thing. So our idea of that could easily be that the husband wields a forceful power that subdues and perhaps abuses the wife. And that is not the biblical idea. The biblical idea is that, you know, the husband's authority is such that he wears the crown of thorns like Christ, you know. And so there is hierarchy, but it is fluid, and it has to do with, it's really based on love and servanthood for everybody, so it's interactive. And so Lewis, I think, is subverting with, you know, his lovely irony, our own chauvinism.
C.S. Lewis wrote a ton of books. There are three in this trilogy. There are, of course, many others. And you mentioned earlier that this was his favorite or one of his favorites?
Yeah, it's absolutely, I would say, the favorite emotionally. Later on, he did think that, well, you know, Till We Have Faces is probably my best book. But Perelandra, I mean, his friend Roger Lancelin Green, you know, records this. And that Lewis, you know, he'd look up into the night sky and he would say, oh, Perelandra, you know. So he has this love for the concept of Venus, the planet of love, and of course the whole idea of perfection. And, you know, people like Walter Hooper, you know, will say, you know, Perelandra was really probably his most perfect book. It certainly is absolutely gorgeous.
Perelandra was published in 1943. The previous book in the trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, came out in 1938. Why did it take him 5 years?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So I would say, first of all, he was a really busy professor. I think the biggest reason, it was really hard to do. He talked about that. He said it's really hard to create an unfallen Eve because she's got to be like a goddess and she's got to be like the mother of God. And how do you put that together? Because in our world, we just don't get that. So, and he said, you know, basically it was really worth trying. In terms of how long it actually took him to write it, well, the earliest we know that he was working on it was 1941, and he finished it in 1942. So I almost think that in terms of the actual writing, it was probably a year, maybe a little bit more.
And maybe the Second World War got in the way.
Well, that was all part of it, of course, to, you know, write these books in the context, this one and That Hideous Strength, in the context of World War II.
Now, you mentioned That Hideous Strength. That's the third book in the trilogy. It's the one we'll discuss next week. Help us connect Perelandra to That Hideous Strength. How does Lewis set us up in this book for the next one?
So first of all, in the seventh planet, we're looking at the masculine, Melisandre. In Perelandra, of course, the feminine principle. In that hideous strength, he pulls it all together, and we have the whole glorious descent of the gods passage there and so on, the ruling Eldila coming to Earth. Anyway, so in that hideous strength, we're not on an outer space planet. We're on home turf. We're in England. And so Lewis is showing what scientism looks like at home. And how far-reaching it is, and really the fear that people like Lewis had, and of course Aldous Huxley and so on, of technocracy, this whole worship of scientism, technocracy, how that is going to, as Lewis said, abolish humanity. So the whole trilogy is really much about the religion of scientism.
How did you discover C.S. Lewis and come to enjoy his work so much that you become a scholar of him?
Thanks for that question. I discovered him as a teenager, and Mere Christianity was the book, first book I knew about. And I read that and I thought, wow, this is fantastic. This is like confirmation, like catechism, but better. It's beautiful. And then I found out more about, you know, Narnia and so on. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. This is like, you know, Bible and fairy tales. So for myself, I was raised on the Bible and German fairy tales. And Lewis just kind of put it all together. All my education has been outside of the church, has been a public school education. And so reading Lewis was incredibly, besides inspiring and wonderful and encouraging, but he really helped me to learn how to speak to people who didn't believe in God, and to really, you know, try to think logically and to say things clearly. So he just became sort of my main mentor, I would say. And I never actually imagined that I'd be a professor focusing on Lewis. I thought I would be focusing on Milton and Chaucer and so on, which I also teach and love to do. But it just developed, it just unfolded that I have had wonderful opportunities to focus on Lewis.
The Space Trilogy was published in the 1930s and 1940s. It's been around for a long time. What's the case for reading the Space Trilogy now in the 2020s?
I think it's even more relevant now because Lewis certainly was prophetic. He wasn't the only one. I've mentioned Aldous Huxley, and we could mention George Orwell. Spoke highly, actually, of hideous strength. He didn't like the religious part, but the idea that it's totally plausible that we could just kind of technocracy. So as we are looking at scientism, as we are looking at, you know, increasing faith in technology and also fear of technology, the loss of privacy, shaping of mass formation, like the shaping of values, how, what people think, this was all dramatized for us in the Space Trilogy. And I think that Lewis really helps us to see things that we might otherwise miss, and also gives us courage to address them.
Monica Hilder, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about Perelandra by C.S. Lewis.
Thank you so very much.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at haymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @haymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.